happy Tuesday, everyone. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian Wimpen, William Tincup, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about human resources. And Brian is in a meeting today, so it's William and I talking to you today with our wonderful guest. So, William, how are you doing?
I am doing fantastic. In fact, Brian's over in Charleston with People Matter, and they just secured an additional, I want to say it's $19 million in funding for their talent management platform that focuses on the hourly market. So he's over there, and they've just moved into a new corporate headquarters in downtown Charleston, and we're just really excited for him. I'm an advisor to that firm. Brian's PeopleClues is a partner to that firm, and so that's why he's not on the call. He's actually over there both celebrating their new headquarters but also helping them celebrate the closing of that round of funding. So I'm doing great. Thank you for asking, Nisha.
Well, that's awesome. So without further ado, let's talk to our guest. A leading expert on the quantitative analysis of workplace practices, Stephanie Thomas. Hey, Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Well, do us a favor. Introduce yourself to the audience, and then we'll see what's kind of going on in your world.
Sure. As I said, my name is Stephanie Thomas, and I am an economic and statistical consultant. And I primarily specialize in the quantitative analysis of workplace practices, just like you said. That would be, you know, things like discrimination in applicant screening, hiring, promotion, termination, discrimination in compensation and benefits, really looking at the data and the numbers underlying the company's workforce and, you know, using statistics to make sure that everything's on the up and up and to identify potential problem areas before they turn into full-blown problem areas.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So what's keeping you up at night?
Well, a couple of things keeping me up at night. The first thing is at the end of last month, just like a week or so ago, the OFCCP rescinded their compensation standards and guidelines. And for those of you who aren't federal contractors, that may not seem like a big deal, but essentially the regulatory agency now has taken away employers' guidance on how to examine their compensation practices for discrimination, and employers are really left with no guidance on the tools and techniques that the OFCCP will use to look at their data. So, I mean, the way I see it from my perspective, we're left with a guidance void, so to speak, because of this rescission. And I think that's going to put employers in a difficult spot.
Wow. Well, I got to dig into a couple things here with you. And after the break, I want to ask you a lot about your book and kind of get into that process. But before we do, I've been reading a lot about Google's people analytics lately. Have you been reading the same stuff? And do you have a thought around kind of their take around people analytics?
I have been reading that stuff, and I think it's fascinating. I'm a data person. I love data. I love, you know, digging through, you know, terabytes of data, trying to identify patterns. And I think that what Google is doing is going to set the stage for what a lot of companies will be doing in the future. I think that their use of analytics in all areas of the company, not just, you know, the typical business stuff like acquisition of new customers and web traffic and stuff like that, they're really digging into what makes a good supervisor good. How do we distinguish between, you know, a mediocre leader and a really, really good leader? And they're coming up with some interesting insights. A lot of them are common sense things. I mean, you know, you want people who are good communicators. We all know that. But through the use of analytics, they're now able to quantify that and really put a hard number on it, which, you know, makes it easier to sell when you're talking to senior management and C-level. So I think it's a fascinating thing. I'm all about analytics.
Nice. What are the edges for you in the things that you do? What are the edges of things that we can measure and should measure versus things that, well, we can't?
I think that there's a tendency to measure a lot of stuff. We're sort of data crazy anymore. I mean, we've got, you know, personal computers that can process tons and tons more information than they ever could. You know, we've got sleep trackers. We've got these Fitbit things that track how many steps a day you take and how many flights of stairs you climb. So everybody is really getting into the data analytics. And I really think it's a question of not what can we measure, but what should we measure? You know, a lot of the times, you know, talk about applicant tracking, for instance. We can talk about the number of applicants that we get for a position. We can talk about the number that are disqualified by any particular screening device. But what does that really tell you? You need to think carefully about what it is you're trying to address. I think we need to stay away from numbers and data for data's sake and really focus on the intelligence behind it. What can we learn? You know, if we're interested in looking at our recruiting efforts in minority markets, for instance, the count of applicants really isn't going to tell you anything. You need to dig deeper into the demographics and the EEO characteristics. And when it comes to compensation, a lot of the things that I think we should be measuring are very difficult to measure. You know, to give you an example, we all know about the gender pay gap. And we've heard this, you know, 77-cent statistic that women earn 23 cents for every dollar women earn 77 cents for every dollar that men earn. And everybody automatically assumes that that's because of discrimination. But when you really start to look at the research underlying that, there's a variety of differences. There's the cash benefits trade-off. There are differences by gender in salary expectations, willingness to engage in negotiations. Those are the kinds of things I think that are really going to help us make progress in terms of moving forward with understanding where our workplace issues are coming from. But those things are really, really difficult to measure. And it almost becomes a blend of, you know, traditional human resources and psychometrics and psychology and, you know, sociological cultural factors. So I think if we're really going to answer the questions that need to be answered, we're going to have to incorporate those psychometric, soft data kind of aspects. And that's something that's really hard to do.
Nice. If your, you know, sister, brother, best friend was taking a leading HR role, and they really asked your advice around what they should measure. You know, obviously you can measure, you know, 10,000 things, let's say, but you really, four or five things gives you the pulse of the organization. What advice would you give them in terms of keep your eye on these numbers?
Well, I think the first one is retention. You need to know what your retention rate is because that's going to sort of be the overall barometer of what's going on. If you've got incredibly high turnover, that should throw up a red flag immediately that something is going on somewhere. Either you're not hiring the right people or there's a problem with your culture, there's a problem with management somewhere. So retention is sort of the frontline defense. I think it's important to keep data on the training and development efforts of the organization, which employees go through training, link how that training affects their performance. You know, we can spend thousands and thousands of dollars sending people to conferences and training sessions, but you really want to be able to measure what impact, if any, it's having on their performance. So, you know, the organizational development, training, performance area is something to definitely keep an eye on. Personally, I think compensation metrics are really, really important. And by compensation metrics, I don't mean, you know, what somebody's salary is relative to the market rate or, you know, industry surveys, benchmarks, things like that. I'm talking about internal pay equity. And aside from the fact that, you know, paying men and women or whites and non-whites differently is a violation of equal employment laws, if you have internal pay equity, you can really take advantage of the competitive advantages and business strategies that come with it. You're going to be able to attract and retain higher quality people. You're going to be able to leverage those skills and abilities. You're going to have a better competitive advantage. It's going to play better with your customers and the general public, so it's going to increase your sales. So, I mean, if I had to pick three, I think those would be the three that I would pick.
Nice. That's wonderful. Let me ask a pay equity. This is going to be a dumb question, so please be gentle in your response. But do we look at like objects? Meaning, you know, do we sort for region and or degrees? Because I'm wondering about, you know, a male in the Northeast versus a female in rural Alabama. And they're doing, quote-unquote, the same job, but maybe because of degree or maybe because of location. Is all that sorted out? Like, when we look at pay equity, do we look at, like, you know, a like person of like degrees and like regions or not? Or am I kind of overthinking it?
No, you're absolutely right. And ideally, that's exactly what you want to do. You want to make sure that you're comparing people who are, the official term is similarly situated. And basically what that means is you don't want to compare the salary of the CEO with the salary of the CEO's administrative assistant, because there's going to be differences based on, you know, the function of the job, the levels of responsibility, required skills and training, and all that stuff. You know, to go back to your example, whether or not you control for geographic region or educational attainment, you certainly can, but that's really going to be driven by the way in which salaries are determined. So if you give a geographic adjustment or a locality adjustment, then obviously you're going to want to incorporate that into an analysis. If geography doesn't matter and you pay, you know, a white male who's 40 years old in New York the same as you pay the white male who's 40 years old in, you know, East Fifth, wherever, then you shouldn't control for it because it's not part of the process. So you really need to understand how those compensation decisions are made, what factors are used, and why people who might look to be the same may be compensated differently. And it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. Differences by organization, differences within organization, by department, by line of business, by functional area of responsibility. It's really an art as much as a science.
What's an example of the best kind of compensation communication strategy that you've ever seen where, you know, people really understand, A, what their compensation package looks like, but also where they fit in an overall model? And you don't have to give a client name or anything like that, but just you can. I really want the audience to kind of understand, here's a really, really keen way to communicate something that is rather complex and can be unwieldy, and here's a way to kind of make it make sense for their audience.
Right. I think the key in any kind of communication is transparency. It's important for people to understand, you know, what they have to do to obtain the bonus or the next promotional increase. It's important for them to understand how their performance is being measured and, you know, on what criteria the organization's view of their success is based. I think the idea is to give enough detail, but not too much detail. My management professor back in college said, you know, you can use it as the analogy of a girl's skirt. It's got to be long enough to cover everything, but short enough to keep it interesting. You need to find a balance in the amount of detail that you're providing in these communications. But I think, you know, transparency is key. And when we think about fairness, there's really four aspects. There's the distributional fairness, which is, you know, am I getting the number of dollars that I think I should get? There's procedural fairness. Are the criteria that are used to dole out those dollars fair? You know, there's the informational fairness component, which is, do I have enough information to understand how those decisions were made? And then there's the communications portion of it, which is really the warm, fuzzy versus cold, prickly, how that information is communicated, how it's presented to you. And you know, even though your employees may disagree with your compensation decisions, I think if you're transparent about it, you tell them about those objective criteria that the decisions were based on, even if they don't agree with it, they're going to understand it and they're likely to respect that decision.
Nice. I want to ask about discrimination and technology and get your take on, are we more, do we discriminate more now because of technology, or do you see that we discriminate less, or do people know that how to bend technology to their will, and people that are going to discriminate are going to discriminate no matter what the technology stack? So really I'm looking at for any type of connection between technology and discrimination that you see.
That is a fascinating area, and the thing that immediately comes to mind is social media, particularly in the hiring process. You know, you can go to LinkedIn and look up pretty much anybody you want to look up. You can find out, you know, where they went to school, where their last job was, you know, how what their special skills and abilities are. You know, if you go look them up on Facebook, you can probably find out what organizations they belong to. The danger there is all of these social media profiles have pictures, right? So you can usually tell if somebody is a male or a female. You may be able to figure out their race and ethnicity in broad terms from the photos. You may be able to tell if they have a disability. You might be able to tell if they're pregnant. All of these things are protected characteristics that can't come into play when making a decision. And I think that there's a real danger of unintentionally violating, you know, the equal opportunity laws. Not that somebody's going to go and say, well, we're only going to screen through these LinkedIn profiles and we're going to pick the men and we're not going to look at the women. But I think, you know, at an unconscious level, at a minimum, there's an opportunity for this. And that's what really concerns me about the video resume trend. I have mixed feelings about the video resumes. On the one hand, I think it's great. You know, it gives you an opportunity to really communicate with your prospective employer and give them a taste of who you are and what you can do. But on the other hand, you know, if you're an employer and you're accepting those video resumes, it really opens up a whole new arena of risk that can be managed, but you have to make sure that you have the right policies and procedures in place. You know, the people who are going to discriminate, I think, are going to find a way to discriminate no matter what. But I think that technology is opening new areas of concern. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's increasing discrimination, but employers have to be prepared to deal with that increased risk with, you know, some sort of a policy or procedure where the information that they're not supposed to have access to is restricted from the decision-making process.
Well, nice, great insight, Stephanie. I'm going to do a quick reset, everybody. This is Nisha and William talking to our wonderful guest, Stephanie. Well, that's true. Like, technology can create some type of discrimination. And let's talk a little bit about adverse impact. As you said, you know, social media, recruiting candidates using social media, our recruiters, for knowingly or unknowingly, they are actually invading privacy of their candidates, right? So what could be some potential dangers for employers, and how can they avoid it?
Well, I mean, the situation depends on whether you're using a third-party recruiter or you're using an in-house recruiter. The bad news for employers is that, you know, you can be on the hook for something that a third-party sourcing firm does. I would like to believe that intentional discrimination is on the decline, you know, and that we as a society and we as human beings are evolving beyond that. But some of the court cases that we see would indicate otherwise. You know, there was a case a few years ago about a staffing company that was referring to black female candidates as chocolate cupcakes. So, you know, I think that there are bad apples out there, and I think they're going to continue to do what they do. Organizations have to be able to identify who those bad actors are and have some sort of policy in place to circumvent that. Social media is a huge concern with recruiting and disparate impact. And again, disparate impact, remember, adverse impact is unintentional discrimination. So, you know, it's a facially neutral policy or practice that has different effects on different groups. And, you know, the classic example here is if we look at social media and job postings, the demographics of the typical LinkedIn user, for example, tend to be white, They tend to be highly educated, and they tend to have, you know, higher earning history. So if you're posting an entry-level job on LinkedIn, and that's your only source, the candidates that you attract through LinkedIn are going to be different than the candidates you would attract if you posted it on, you know, Career Builder or Monster, or put an ad in the local newspaper or trade publication. So I think there's a potential danger there to sort of alter the composition of the applicant pool that you would otherwise get. Now, that being said, I think it's perfectly fine to use social media for recruiting, but it can't be the only tool that you use. And I think that's the key, is really a balanced approach. It's perfectly fine to use social media and use LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, you know, whatever social media tools you want to use, but make sure that you also cover those conventional sources as well and really take a balanced approach, and that's going to help prevent adverse impact.
Well, great. Well, over time, as things evolve, you know, people get terminated due to various factors, like it could be union organization or ethnicity issue or even social media. So where do you see the kind of risk areas or the, you know, the uptake in the next years where organizations should take care?
Well, the termination issue is interesting. I mean, I think all companies have been struggling with terminations for the last few years, given, you know, the collapse in 2008-2009. The NLRB in the last year has come down with some rulings about the Facebook firing issue, whether or not posting something on Facebook is a protected concerted activity and whether or not you can be fired for that. I really think that the jury's still out on that. I don't think that we have any real answer, and I don't think that there ever is going to be a bright line for, you know, you can say this on Facebook about your boss, but you can't say that. And if you say this, you can get fired, but if you say that, then you don't. So I think it's going to be a gray issue. You know, and my best advice for employers is to talk to legal counsel about it. Make sure that, you know, you stay up to date on what's going on. Be aware of the issue and, you know, get help when you need it, when you have concerns. And, you know, don't ignore anything, don't make any decisions without consulting with legal counsel, because it really is a very muddy, murky area right now.
Nice. And Stephanie, for the audience, Stephanie has a fantastic podcast herself, the Proactive Employer. I've been on it and absolutely enjoyed myself on it. So no wonder she's so comfortable on the radio. She has a fantastic show herself. And Stephanie, I want to segue, I want to segue into your book. A, what is your book about? And if you don't mind, take us into the process of why you created a book and what you learned from the book writing experiment.
Sure. The book is called Compensating Your Employees Fairly, A Guide to Internal Pay Equity, and it's coming out mid to late April. It's going to be published by A-Press, and it really walks you through the whole compensation self-review process in common sense terms. The motivation behind the book is sort of selfish, if I can say that. I wrote the book to give people a better understanding of what's involved, what the scope of this kind of activity is, what the benefits of being proactive about your compensation policies and practices really is. And I say it's selfish because the more that I can educate employers, my potential clients, the easier my job comes. So it takes a lot of the technical details of multiple regression analysis and means and medians and all that kind of stuff and really breaks it down into what I hope is very non-technical in presentation. I try to really boil it down to, you know, this is what it really means. If you want the formulas, you can go look them up in a stats textbook. But, you know, this is what it really means for the bottom line. This is what it really means for your business processes. And I think one of the challenges of writing the book was to really make sure that I had a firm grasp on what those practical implications really were. It allowed me, forced me, gave me the opportunity to really think about the linkage between the statistics and the math and the data and, you know, what's really happening on the front lines inside of corporations.
Nice. I want you to put on, we got about 5 minutes left in the show. I want you to put on your futurist hat for a moment. What does compensation look like in the year 2050?
Oh, wow. Well, again, I don't want to equivocate, but I'm not sure that I can give you a blanket answer. I think it's going to depend on the industry, depend on the size of the company. One of the things that I would like to see happen is more incorporation of, you know, the total reward strategy rather than just focusing on health insurance and a base salary and maybe a Christmas bonus at the end of the year, to really, you know, look into those five aspects of total rewards. Things like, you know, organizational development and training opportunities, you know, certainly the work-life balance is important. You know, we can't be productive at work if we're burned out. We need time to rest and rejuvenate. So I would hope that a broader total rewards perspective is taken. I think we're probably going to see a shift to greater focus on pay for performance. A lot of companies say that they have pay for performance, but it's not really a pay for performance system. I think that we're going to see a hardening, a quantification of pay for performance and really clarifying what it is companies are paying their employees for. And I also think we're going to see, what I would like to see, is more of a gamification approach to compensation. You know, we've got social media, we've got these, you know, gamification of healthcare services and tracking your workouts and, you know, all this kind of stuff. There's an emerging trend where companies are using these gamification processes in their compensation system. They give every employee 20 tokens, and they can give those to, you know, their fellow employees. Whoever gets the most tokens gets, you know, a zip line trip, or they get, you know, an extra bonus or whatever. But I think it's an innovative element that I think really could revive a lot of compensation systems and really help to boost employee morale, engagement, and, you know, really take things to the next level.
Well, Stephanie, thank you so much. It's been such a great conversation. So let our audience know, you know, where people can find and connect with you.
Sure. You can certainly feel free to give me a call, 215-642-0072. You can send me an email. It's my first initial and last name, S. Thomas, at thomasecon.com. You can find me on Twitter at Proactive Employer. And you can find my radio show, theproactiveemployer.com. Just go to any search engine, and I'm sure I'll pop up somewhere.
Well, that's great. Well, we have about a minute, so I have one last question. How can our HR professionals or employers take a hands on latest policies and laws or employment laws? What do you suggest, any website or any other resources?
Well, I think it really depends on the issue. Certainly the Department of Labor and the EEOC have a lot of guidance on, you know, the equal opportunity stuff for federal contractors. Check out the OFCCP website. SHRM also has a variety of resources, you know, compensation and benefits and hiring and handbooks and all that kind of stuff. And really just, you know, search for a hashtag on Twitter. You'll be surprised at the informational resources that you'll find just from a simple hashtag search.
Well, awesome. Awesome, Stephanie. So thank you so much for being with us today, and it's been such an amazing conversation. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are out of here. So thank you for listening to Drive to HR. Bye-bye.